Playmate Land, what are we doing? Like, is this Hugh Hefner? He creates an island for tourists, but it's an animal-themed island?
Yeah, it makes no sense. I'm like,
no wonder your daughter doesn't like you. You're a dirty old man.
Yeah, you're kind of a sleazeball.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
And we are talking all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
Today, modern man is preoccupied by the mysteries of outer space. Scientists are probing farther and farther away from Earth. And yet, here on this very world we live in, are hidden mysteries. Mysteries better left alone. Or if they are disturbed, they could destroy the world. And now, an expedition goes to a strange South Sea island.
Forbidden jungle. To a forbidden village. Breaking taboos that anger the gods.
Gappa! Gappa angry! Gappa! Gappa angry! Angry!
Revenge of the Monsters. The selfish whim of a magazine publisher.
In this park, I will have strange tropical animals.
Results in horrible destruction.
The monsters can actually think, and in addition, they can communicate with others of their own species.
Worldwide terror.
Matt Levine, yo Gabba Gabba, yo Gappa Gappa.
Should the Triphibian monster himself.
What element are you tonight? Are you sea, sky, or land?
Let's say sky. I'm feeling that way today.
All right. I'm going to say sea. I'm the ocean. Maybe drowning a little bit, but I'm holding my own.
All right, nice. Is that a reference to Triphibian? I have to admit, I don't know exactly what that means.
I believe that is the root origin of Triphibian. Because I guess, they can travel in those three elements.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I should have thought of that before now. I was just like, I don't know what Triphibian means. Oh, well, who cares? But I probably should have thought about that a little bit more. But yeah, that makes sense. And it makes sense given the gap of monsters in the movie, too.
I don't know if anyone knew really what it means. Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah. Did they make up that word for this movie, or is that... I should have done this research already, sorry.
You is didn't look enough? Up the etymology of Triphibian? Neither I should did have. I. Let's do it.
Let's see.
Listeners...
Here.
Listeners, this is going to be a good episode. Today, we are talking about Gappa, the Triphibian Monster, a 1967 kaiju picture from Nikkatsu Studios, a rival studio of Toho and Daiei. And we're going to get into this underseen, maybe underappreciated kaiju movie and talk about kind of the oddities of this film, including... Triphibian. Where did it come from? Where did it go? We'll find out.
I think it is an actual word in my very quick research that I did. It's in Merriam-Webster. It doesn't really have a lot in the word history section, but yeah, it's a word. That's all I can tell you.
It is a word. Okay. It means something that can operate on land, sea, and in the air. Like a giant monster.
Yep. Like a mom and dad monster that just wants to get their baby back.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
So, you know, they can team up with Mama Gorgo too.
Yeah, since this movie is perhaps just a ripoff of Gorgo, but we'll talk about that more, I'm sure.
Perhaps. Who did it better, though? That's going to be the question.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, how the hell are you?
I'm doing pretty well. This is pretty much my favorite time of year. We're recording this in early November, so Halloween just happened. The fall colors are bright and beautiful. Today was like in the mid-60s in the Twin Cities. It was also voting day in the Twin Cities and obviously a lot of other places as well. So yeah, beautiful day today. I love this time of year.
This is also my favorite time of year. Every Tuesday night, sitting down to record.
Shucks. This particular Tuesday night, though, this is our first recording after Halloween, so I'm still feeling the post-Halloween glow.
Yeah. And our last episode was 20 Million Miles to Earth with Naomi.
Mm-hmm.
Loved recording that. Love that movie. I am such a huge fan of all monster movies, the Universal movies, off-the-wall kind of offbeat types of films, but this is Camp Kaiju, and it is always great to get back to the traditional kaijus. And I am including the Emir from 20 Million Miles to Earth, but Gappa, it's Japanese kaiju. We're getting back to the home country, and I think it's a fun movie to talk about, you know, flaws and all.
Yeah, I agree. It's good to get back to like the genuine, true definition of kaiju. It's good to get back to like, you know, a Japanese monster movie where there's no question these are kaijus in this movie. I almost feel like the movie is a little bit too content to be like, yeah, we're going back to basics. We're just going to repeat all the cliches of every kaiju movie you've ever seen. I think Gappa the Triphibian Monster definitely does that, but that's not necessarily a totally bad thing.
Yep. I've felt that the whole time watching it. But we'll get there. We've got some nuts and bolts to get through. First, friends, we do not take you for granted. All you listeners out there, thank you for listening to every episode. We really appreciate it. And if you could leave us a rating and review to express that joy and that appreciation, we would be eternally grateful. You can send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or Instagram @camp_kaiju_podcast. I love reading those here on the show, sharing them with everybody. If you'd even like to go one step further and feature your own voice on the show, you can do that with a voicemail. 612-470-2612. Tell us about your favorite monster movies. What element are you feeling tonight? And check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com. Subscribe to the website. We have subscribers on there. So thank you specifically, listeners, for doing that on the website. You can hit up our Threadless store, campkaiju.threadless.com, for t-shirts, mugs, stickers, a whole host of things. You can become a patron. Yes, all you super listeners out there who have not yet made the switch to even just a $5 a month patron, you can do that at patreon.com/campkaiju. Now, I will tell you right now, we've got discounts on all that merch. If you leave a comment as a patron, we'll shoot your thoughts right up to the top of our list. If we do have live events, I know we say this often, we're always working on things, but we really are. And one day when they happen, we'll treat you like the VIP that you are. Now, what I'll say is season 6 is coming up, Matt. And I do want to revamp our Patreon a little bit. All TBD, but let's have a Patreon drive starting now in November and December of 2025. If you sign up at any level for Patreon, all you listeners who I know are out there wanting to do it, we will send you a tote bag. How do you feel about that, Matt? Would you like a tote bag with Camp Kaiju's logo on it?
I would love one. Man, this is all news to me. This is exciting. I've been looking for a way to carry around my belongings whenever I leave the house. That's perfect.
Yes, and you could tell people about monster movies, and they'll say, what is that awesome logo on your bag? And you'll say, it's Camp Kaiju. They talk about all of our favorite movies. And then you're, boom, you've made a connection, you've made a friend, and you're just growing the love for giant monster movies.
Yeah, I think I have to do that. Maybe in the tote bag, I'll put nothing but like monster figurines just to like continue the conversation, you know? To get
whatever you put in your tote bags, everybody, that's on you. We won't, you don't need to share what's in your tote bag. But if you want a tote bag, join us at Patreon. Any level gets you in. And then I am toying around with the idea of a once a month happy hour where on Zoom, if you are a Patreon, we can have a hangout for an hour, answering your questions about the show, just chatting about movies, nerding out, like a movie club once a month for Patreon members. How do you feel about that?
I like it. I like it. All kaiju all the time. That's cool. I'm excited about that.
I like that. Maybe that'll be the name of the happy hour. All kaiju all the time. That could be on your tote bag.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
I do too, actually. I'm legitimately writing that down.
Our new slogan. I didn't even mean to come up with it, but there you go.
So, listeners, what are you waiting for? Visit patreon.com/campkaiju today for all that and a tote bag of chips.
Amazing. I didn't know there were changes to Patreon coming up. This is news to me and very pleasant news, I might add.
Yes, all of our patrons are amazing. Jason, Chris B, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. All right. And don't you fret, loyal patrons. You will get your tote bag as well. Okay. Well, ring-a-ding, it is November. Let's talk about some monster movies that came out this month in monster movie history. Ooh, we got some known titles here.
Some classics
catching your eye.
I think the one that I'll shout out, even though I haven't seen it in a very long time, is called At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul. It's a Brazilian movie from 1964. I haven't seen it since I was an undergrad in college, so that was, I'll just say, a long time ago now at this point. And I don't really remember it all that well, but it's the first appearance of a character named Coffin Joe, who became sort of like a popular figure in Brazilian horror cinema. And from what I remember, he's kind of like he's an undertaker, but he's also kind of a mix of like a vampire and a zombie a little bit who wants to achieve immortality. I just remember it's very creepy, has very beautiful black and white cinematography, and again, kind of gave rise to this phenomenon in Brazilian cinema, even though I haven't seen any of the other Coffin Joe movies. I would like to at some point, and it all started with At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul.
Very cool. I love that. Wow. There's just so many like little rabbit holes to go down in our favorite genre. That's crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm due for a rewatch on that one.
That reminds me of the Mexican hero El Santo, the Mexican wrestler who turned movie star in the 60s and 70s with a series of horror films called Santo versus the Evil Brain from 1961. Let's see, Santo versus the Zombies, 1962. Santo versus the Mummies, the Vampires. Like this guy, it's like if The Rock was making these movies. And I want to watch these movies too. I know El Santo's huge and I just haven't gotten into those yet. But real quick, I was watching Coco, the Pixar movie, the other night. And in the afterlife, where everybody lives while they wait for their Day of the Dead return, El Santo shows up as a little cameo character. He's trying to get into a VIP party. And I was just, you know, the last time I watched Coco, I had no idea who El Santo was, but there he was.
I feel like I vaguely remember that because I've known about El Santo for a long time. And I think when I only saw Coco when it came out, so kind of a long time ago at this point. But I feel like I remember that joke. It's a good one.
Yeah. But anyways, what was released in November? Probably an El Santo movie. But what I'm going to shout out is a film called The Land That Time Forgot from 1974. It is based on a novel by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So it's an adventure fantasy movie with dinosaurs and cave people. I've never seen it, but I have always had like the bargain bin DVD. And before I got into Camp Kaiju, it was just like a DVD I never paid attention to. But now that I'm into monster movies, I'm like, oh, I have that. I should watch that at some point.
But you've never seen it before?
Nope.
Gotcha. I've heard that title. It's kind of like a cult classic in a way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I feel like you kind of just said that, but
no,
yeah.
That's all right. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll bring it to the pod someday.
Maybe. I've got a lot of movies like that in my collection that I've never watched, but they're waiting. I'll get to them at some point.
Who knows what treasures await?
Including Monster from a Prehistoric Planet, which is the title of the AIP American release of Gappa, the Triphibian Monster. Matt, I have two copies of Monster from a Prehistoric Planet. I've had these for years. I had no idea what I was sitting on. It was Gappa.
Yeah. And like the American version is pretty similar, right? From the little bit that I've read, like it's dubbed into English and like the title over the opening, or sorry, the song over the opening credits is different. But other than that, there aren't too many changes. Am I correct about that?
It's largely the same. They're just minor differences. Mm-hmm. And I got to be honest with you. I tried to watch Monster from a Prehistoric Planet, and because it's a bargain bin DVD, the transfer was atrocious. Apparently, most of these AIP editions, these days they're like in the public domain, so they're just like copied dupe of a 16 millimeter TV viewing from 30 years ago. So it's all very terribly, it's just rendered.
Yeah,
honestly, I couldn't watch it. But if you watch Gappa on Tubi, the original, just Gappa the Triphibian Monster, night and day difference. It's in lush, beautiful, vibrant colors. It's like a real movie. So be forewarned out there, folks, if you too have a copy of Monster from a Prehistoric Planet.
The same exact thing happened to me. The first version I saw like online was Monster from a Prehistoric Planet. I started it, could not handle how terrible it looked, and then found Gap on Tubi. So I did exactly what you just mentioned, and yeah, the version on Tubi is, it looks pretty great. It's a good transfer and everything. I usually tend to prefer the subtitled version anyway, and in this case, it just looked infinitely better than the American one that I found.
Oh my gosh, it's astoundingly different.
Yeah, right. It's amazing how much of a difference it makes.
Like, what? I couldn't get through it. So.
Yeah. And also, Gap of the Triphibian Monster is just a way cooler title. I mean, Monster from a Prehistoric Planet is a pretty good title, don't get me wrong, but like, the Japanese title is way better, in my opinion.
Both don't make sense in their own ways, but yeah. I feel like Gap of the Triphibian Monster makes less sense, but in a truly intriguing way. Like, I'm like, oh, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Monster from a Prehistoric Planet. I'm like, I don't know. Is it just like a dinosaur movie? Like, I'm not really invested in finding out what that means.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's the end of the podcast, everybody. Links in the show notes.
Yep. The end. We're not going to tell you if it's good, bad, or campy. You'll have to find out for yourself.
All right. What's coming up here on the show and in the world? Well, today, as of yesterday, was Godzilla Day, November 3rd. Happy 71st birthday to Godzilla. But it was announced the sequel to Godzilla Minus One will be titled Godzilla Minus Zero. And the assumed release date will be sometime late next year, 2026. Not much is known. The plot is not known about this story, about this movie. Although I did hear that some shooting locations will happen in Norway and somewhere else, which is like a big deal because usually Godzilla movies aren't shot outside of Japan, like the Toho productions. So I don't know. Will there be another monster involved?
What's going on? I hope so.
I hope so too.
Cool. That's exciting. I don't want to sound like a hater. I feel like I don't love Godzilla Minus One quite as much as most other people do. Still a good movie, in my opinion, but I'm excited for the sequel. I have high hopes for it.
Yeah. Yeah. We love our solo Godzilla movies, but I think we all actually really love when there's more than one monster in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it goes that way, I hope so.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming up on Camp Kaiju, your pick. What do you got for us?
Yeah, the next one that I'm bringing to the podcast is The Addiction, directed by Abel Ferrara from 1995. I've been curious about this movie for a long time. It's very well reviewed, and it's technically about vampires, but I've read that that's kind of a metaphor for drug addiction in this movie, as the title implies. Mm. And Lily Taylor is the lead actress in the movie. Excited to watch it. And I believe Frank Olson will be joining us. 90% sure that that's the case. So excited to have him back on the podcast.
Fantastic. And then following that, we will get back to our kaiju offerings with Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim. And along with that episode, we will also have our traditional holiday episode with returning guests, and you and I can reveal the first 6 months worth of films for season 6 of Camp Kaiju.
Season 6, amazing. How you must be so proud that this is going to be the 6th season.
6 seasons. I think this is going to be my 5th year doing this. And we've been doing it for like 4 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Couldn't do it without you.
Well, thank you, but thank you for inviting me 4 years ago, and I didn't know what I was in for, all the fun conversations we would have, but congratulations. This is your brainchild, of course, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, seriously, congrats to you too. There are episodes now, like there are movies I watch where I'm like, yeah, the last time I saw that was for the podcast 4 years ago when me and Matt did an episode on it.
Yeah. Man, time flies.
Oh, it really does. Like that's, yeah, but no, it feels good. It feels good. So yeah. I'm excited. I'm still kicking around some titles, but I'll be ready.
Same. I might try to do a certain theme to my picks for next season, but we'll, you know, to be continued. We'll talk more about that soon.
Okay. More kaiju all the time. I already forgot the slogan.
All kaiju all the time.
All kaiju all the time.
100% kaiju.
Pounding across the motion picture screen comes the most terrifying monster of them all. Gamera, the invincible. Gamera, the super monster that even the H-bomb cannot destroy. Gamera, the invincible.
Attention everyone! Hey, time out! Gamera,
consuming raw atomic power. Power to destroy entire cities.
Open fire!
Man's most destructive weapons have no effect on Gamera, the invincible. The mightiest nuclear weapons ever devised are powerless against Gamera, the invincible. Is humanity doomed? Will the world be destroyed? The United Nations is called to emergency session in a last desperate effort to save the world.
We have one plan that we think might work. We have discussed Plan Z with the Japanese authorities, and they agree it is the best of our alternative plans. Is that correct, sir?
That is so. Plan Z is hope of the world.
A cast of thousands at the mercy of the most terrifying monster that ever lived. Brian Donlevy as General Arnold.
Gamera is beyond comprehension. He must be stopped now.
Albert Dekker as the Secretary of Defense. Will Plan Z stop Gamera? Gamera, the invincible.
Ebira and Mothra. In one of the most explosive action pictures ever to hit the screen. From the depths of the ocean comes the most terrifying horror of the deep. From within the mountain caves comes the dreaded monster Godzilla. The most titanic battle ever screened when the monster of the deep challenges the mighty Godzilla.
Fire! No motion picture of our time has ever unleashed shock spectacle of such scope and realism as up from the depths of prehistoric mystery rages Virgo. The headlines of the world blaze the fabulous story of this monster from another age, catapulted from some vast sub-ocean cavern by unprecedented volcanic action. And the headlines scream the story of the reckless skin divers who captured the monster and put it on exhibition.
Stop! Pull up!
Drop the nets!
What are you doing? Hey, take it easy.
I came to let him go back to the sea where he belongs.
Why?
Maybe to save your silly skins for you.
Hurry, hurry, hurry to see Gogo. But the headlines do not record the story of a little boy who had a curious sympathy and understanding for the fantastic creature. What strange secret does he know that scientists only suspect?
You're trying to say there may be a fully grown one of these things around somewhere? How big would a full grown one be?
An approximate guess. The infant? The adult.
That'll make it nearly 200 feet tall.
Wreaking terrible vengeance against the civilization that has captured its offspring. Towering over the cities of the world as millions flee its awesome terror.
Revenge! Revenge while you still terrible! Revenge!
Nothing can stop it. Defying the force of the army. The might of the Navy.
Fire number one, Terry.
Ready to open fire, sir.
File them.
Even the fury of the jets. In a crashing crescendo of sights never before beheld by human eyes and adventures never before experienced by any man or woman.
All right. Well, Gappa the Triphibian Monster, not one, not two, but three kaiju in this film. What is your personal history with this movie?
Pretty much zero. I knew nothing about this movie until, you know, watching it for this episode. And you've talked about it a little bit in the past. And then the title, again, just like jumps out at me because it's so unique. But beyond that, I have zero history with this movie.
You and most of the world, honestly. Yeah. This movie just doesn't get talked about outside of like diehard kaiju film nerds. And I don't know if that's entirely merited. Regardless, I came upon this movie 6 years ago when I was doing my deep dive into the genre. And I was honestly surprised by the film. I didn't expect much. And I threw it on Tubi. And I was pleasantly surprised. So I have been wanting to talk about it for a while. But because it's so underseen, like my producer hat was like, well, maybe I save that one till we have a little bit of an audience. And they can go on that journey with us. So here we go. I'm ready for it.
That makes sense. And probably a good idea to, like, you know, we'll be talking about Pacific Rim in a couple episodes, and probably good to balance out like the obscure deep dive titles with like the blockbusters that everybody knows about, you know?
I think so. You got to give and take a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but we're good at that. I that's what I love about our show too, that we cover all types, underseen, overseen, maybe.
Yeah, right. For sure.
Yeah.
This is going back to what we were just talking about, and I apologize, but I'm just curious, with Pacific Rim and Guillermo del Toro, have you seen Frankenstein yet?
No. Have you?
No, I have not. Yeah, just curious. And Predator Badlands is coming out too, so anyway, sorry to go back to that tangent, just curious if you had seen those yet.
No, I haven't. Listeners, if you had, please let us know. The thing is, I'm pretty bad at getting to the theater these days, just with my limited free time. And I don't have Netflix, which is maybe is a surprise, but but this might be what gets me back onto Netflix just for a little bit, because I'm dying to see it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I don't, you know, sorry not to spend too much time on Frankenstein, but I'm guardedly excited about it. I definitely want to see it. I sound like such a snob, but it, like Guillermo del Toro, usually I'm like, oh, that was okay. I'm not like super excited by his movies, and Frankenstein is like, it seemed like this is the movie that he was born to make and that he's wanted to make for a very long time, to the extent where I'm like, oh yeah, kind of obvious. Like we all knew he was going to make this movie, you know? But I'm sorry, that all sounds like so negative. I am excited to see it, and I've heard good things about it, so it should be good.
Well, let's save our del Toro talk for Pacific Rim.
Yeah, sorry.
And actually, I think we will be joined by Sean Childers, big mech giant robot fan. So, yes, that'll be a good episode. We'll talk about del Toro more then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Awesome. Sorry. Jumping around a little bit.
That's okay. Yeah, let's just dive into the cast and crew of Gappa. These are all Nikkatsu studio actors and crew.
The film was directed by Haruyasu Noguchi. The screenplay was by Iwao Yamazaki and Ryuzo Nakaishi. Vincent, like you just said, these are kind of crew members at Nikkatsu Studio, kind of on their roster of crew members there. The story and special effects were by Akira Watanabe, a former employee at Toho Studios and collaborator of Eiji Tsuburaya, who we know from doing the special effects for many of Toho's kaiju movies. Watanabe left Toho in 1966 after serving as Tsuburaya's art director on Invasion of Astro Monster. I can read off some of his other credits here real quick. Just pulling up the list here.
Yeah. The more of the kaiju films that you mention helps me target any of the trailers that I'm going to include in the episode.
Okay. Well, I'll pick some of the better-known ones, the ones that I know anyway. He was the special effects art director for the original Godzilla, Godzilla Raids Again, Rodan, The Mysterians, Battle in Outer Space, Mothra, Gorath, I feel like I've heard of that, King Kong vs. Godzilla, Matango, which I just watched recently and loved. That's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Atragon, Mothra versus Godzilla, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, another one of my favorites, Frankenstein versus Baragon, Invasion of Astro Monster, I think I mentioned that one, Ultra Q, and that's just some of the highlights. So he definitely has a lot of titles on his filmography.
Definitely.
And then just finishing out the crew here real quick, the film was produced by Hideo Koi, and the cinematography was by Muneo Ueda.
Yeah, and then the cast, big cast, but our main cohort here, Tamio Kawachi as Hiroshi Kurosaki. Kawachi, the actor, long career in TV and film. I happened to see that he was on a couple of Ultraman series in the late 90s. So just, you know, highlighting a kaiju connection there. He, in the movie, he plays one of our young male leads. That's right. There's like a love triangle between two young men, and our female lead, Itoko Koyanagi is the name of the character, played by Yoko Yamamoto. And she is joined by Yuji Okada as Daisy Tonoka, and Koji Wada as Mashida, and Tatsuo Fuji as George, which is strangely American there. But there's our main cast. Now, the production backstory, I think this is where it gets interesting. So 1967, peak kaiju cinema in Japan on the success of the Godzilla series and even Gamera the Giant Monster, which was released by Daiei Studios in 1966. So with especially Gamera's success, other studios jumped on the bandwagon. Nikatsu produced Gappa, its only kaiju film. And another one worth shouting out is a movie called The X from Outer Space from Studio Shochiku. Now, Nikatsu, Matt, do you have any familiarity with this studio?
Yeah, a little bit, mostly because of the next bullet point that you have here, but I can just cover this bullet point real quick if you'd like me to. So yeah, Nikatsu began making movies in 1954 with a lot of historical and samurai films. I don't think they were any of the Akira Kurosawa ones, because I think Kurosawa was a Toho director. But if I remember right, Nikatsu maybe did like Sword of the Beast, Samurai Rebellion possibly, that might have been later. So don't quote me on that. But yeah, they started making historical and samurai films in 1954. By the 60s, they were focusing more on urban youth drama. If I remember right, I believe Nagisa Oshima was an early director for Nikatsu, and I love Nagisa Oshima, a really good Japanese new wave filmmaker. But Gappa was Nikatsu's biggest budget film ever, and like you just said, Vincent, their only kaiju film. The 1970s saw them move into the sexploitation market to stay profitable.
Yeah, a term that I think we've used on this show before, Roman porno.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what that means.
That does sound kind of familiar. I don't know that subgenre very well either, though.
Okay.
I've also heard them referred to in the context of Japanese cinema as pink films. I don't know if that extends to other national cinemas as well, but I've heard some erotic Japanese films referred to as pink films before.
Interesting. Maybe it was our Kinky Kong jokes. I don't remember. But...
that could be. Yeah. We still got to work on our Kinky Kong movie that we're making. We got to work on that script.
Anyways, Nikatsu was bankrupt by the 90s, so they're no longer a functioning studio. But maybe another reason why Gappa has just kind of been lost to time, because the studio behind it is lost to time, and whoever the rights holders are clearly aren't interested in promoting it. So I just think that alone is an interesting quirk of history, that corporations shift and disappear, and what's left with their art, and who's to curate it if nobody cares.
Right. Yeah. And we've seen that with a lot of Hollywood studios too. Like, you know, RKO Studios obviously isn't around anymore. Some of the old like Republic Pictures, like B movies from back in the day, went through like extremely convoluted rights ownership and just archival issues, you know?
Yeah. So that's a little bit on Nikatsu.
Can I correct something I said before? Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't want to say anything blatantly wrong on the podcast. So Nagiso Oshima was not well known as an Akatsu director, but looking at their lineup of directors right now, I feel like the best known ones are probably Seijun Suzuki, who made really psychedelic crime movies like Branded to Kill, for example. And then Shohei Imamura, who made some really great movies also, like Vengeance is Mine is one of those. Another Japanese New Wave director. Those two were Nakatsu directors, but Nagiso Oshima was not. Just want to correct that.
Have you seen those movies?
Some of them. I've seen several Seijun Suzuki movies, which I like a lot. They're very strange. If you're looking for like cohesive plot, they're definitely not very satisfying movies, but they're just like insanely stylish. And they kind of epitomize the Japanese New Wave, which was like very abrasive and in your face. And I like a lot of those movies very much.
Very cool. And I'm just asking, just as a friend now, like, did you just make time to watch those movies or were they part of your film education in school?
A little bit of both, I guess. I feel like I wanted to explore them because, like so many people getting into film at an early age, like you start with Akira Kurosawa and Yasujirō Ozu, who are amazing filmmakers, and then you kind of want to understand a little bit more about Japanese cinema. So like for me, I was just curious why some of the like Kurosawa and Ozu movies kind of indirectly led to these like really weird Japanese New Wave movies from the 60s. And I was just like, how did that happen? These movies are so different than like the more classical style movies, the classics that we know from, again, Kurosawa and some other directors. So I was just like personally interested in it. And then I did see some Japanese movies in college when I was a film student. I remember I took a horror cinema class and we watched a lot of Japanese horror movies from the 60s, which are very political and very much about like the fallout after World War II and, you know, trauma from the atomic bombs and stuff like that. So yeah, mostly a personal interest, but did watch them a little bit in college as well.
That's great. That's really cool. There's just so much. There's so much, so many movies from so many countries. That from so many different, from a century or more of filmmaking, I guess it just takes time.
Right. And it's kind of daunting. It's like how it's hard to specialize in one thing if you want to see it all, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel like I want to, and I think you feel the same way, but I, you know, I want to watch the Hollywood classics and like the indie movies and Japanese cinema. And then like the more sort of like under-celebrated movies like African cinema after a lot of different African countries started gaining independence. I love those. Egyptian cinema is fantastic. So, yeah, I'm kind of rambling a little bit. But just to your point, it's like there's so much out there. How do you find time for all this stuff?
You host a podcast and it forces you to watch things.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good problem to have, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, something like The Addiction, for example. It might be on my list, but I would never prioritize it if it weren't for this podcast. So I am appreciative of that.
Yeah. Same. I don't know if I ever would have seen GAPA if it weren't for the podcast. So, so thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Japanese government, who in the late 60s and early 70s had a financial program to give grants to the studios to make movies that could be then exported to international markets. So that's kind of also what led to this boon in kaiju cinema at the time. Yes, there was the audience want for it, but there was also financial backing from the government. So Nikatsu took this, ran with it. GAPA was their highest budgeted film ever. This one source says 500 million yen, which is today $1.4 million. You know, not a lot by today's standards, but at the time, huge budget. And I think it's reflected in the final product. You could tell that, wow, these effects have money behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Nikatsu had bandied about other ideas for their kaiju movie, including a giant squid that attacks a Nazi U-boat in World War II. You had a giant alien spider that invades Earth, and then you had one idea about a giant flying squirrel. Eventually, they settled on what is now known as the Triphibian Monster. Do you have any thoughts about those other ideas?
I think the giant squid attacking a Nazi U-boat sounds especially awesome. I would love to see that movie. It's like the historical context that that would bring up, like, kind of boggle the mind a little bit, you know? That would have been a very cool movie. And as we've talked about on the podcast, I'm terrified of spiders, so I feel like the giant spider idea would have been cool, too. I don't know about the giant flying squirrel, but who knows? That might be awesome. It's just weird enough that that could work.
Just weird enough. I'll tell you, I think that the Triphibian monsters are pretty weird in and of themselves. I don't know if they always work for me. Just as like a concept, it just seems like somebody in a room just was like, well, I'll add a beak, I'll add some wings, I'll add a tail, you know, just, and like, that's what they came up with.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It kind of reminded me of Gauss a little bit, the monster Gauss, who we've talked about in the podcast before. Gauss looks a little bit cooler, I would say, but just like the avian look of it, you know, and maybe also a Rodan a little bit too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I could see all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about the release and legacy a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So Gappa the Triphibian Monster was released in April 1967 in Japan. American TV rights were purchased by American International Pictures. As we talked about before, it was dubbed and retitled Monster from a Prehistoric Planet. And yeah, Vincent, like you said, like, the fact that American International isn't around anymore means that it's in the public domain, and a lot of those transfers, unlike the bargain DVDs that you find now, are definitely not very good. But yeah, the one on Tubi looked very good, I thought. And I think Tubi has both the subtitled and the dubbed one, so for viewers out there interested in either one, Tubi will have them. Variety kind of surprisingly gave the film a positive review at the time. I think it's surprising.
Well, I do too, because they're probably, I think, reviewing the AIP monsters from a Prehistoric Planet.
I would assume so, yeah. Because that, I don't even think that was released in American cinemas at all. It was only shown on TV in America.
Yeah.
So yeah, I that must be the one that they were reviewing. And again, like the dubbing, you know, some other dubbed movies are decent. I don't think the dubbing was very good in this case. Granted, I didn't watch the whole dubbed version of the movie, but yeah, that's just that. That's what makes it so surprising that Variety gave it a good review, because that's the dubbed version that they must have watched. And Variety wrote that the creature Gappa makes an auspicious debut and reveals itself as the best monster so far. I don't know exactly what that alludes to, though. If it's like the best monster of the year or just like among recent Japanese movies, it's kind of hard to tell from that review. Variety, just to finish this little excerpt here, Variety concluded that these are the only Japanese monsters one might like to see again, and that most effects are well done, a few superb, noting the destruction of the city of Atami as one of the highlights. And I find that kind of baffling. There are many other Japanese monsters that I would probably want to watch before I watched Gappa, but that's maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I could see it. But, you know, does this movie get lost to time for other reasons beyond its control?
Yeah, and we'll obviously talk more about our subjective responses to the film in a moment here. But yeah, I can see the charm in the movie, and I can understand why, like, you know, like coming across it on TV and being like, whoa, what is this weird creature movie? That would be kind of fun. I can see the appeal of that. But I'm just saying, like, to compare this to, like, Gamera and even some of the Godzilla movies from the 60s and say that Gappa is like the best of the Japanese monsters is like, Variety, what are you talking about? What are you doing?
No, I agree. I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit. But let me ask, Gappa or Ebra Horror of the Deep?
Ooh, that's a tough choice, to be honest. I like the design of Ebra more, you know? Like, I think Ebra looks really weird. We don't really get a good look at it in that movie, Ebra, Horror of the Deep. Yeah, I feel like maybe the movie Gappa is a little bit better, but the monster Ebra, I probably prefer a little bit.
I can be down with that.
But, you know, I'll take Gamera, thank you very much. Like, if the choice is between those three, I'd rather have Gamera, I think. Yeah.
Gappa or Ebra, the answer is Gamera.
Right. None of the above.
I'll take Gamera, please.
Yeah.
100%. Well, I added a little bit here that this movie does get compared to Gorgo a lot, just as the basic conceit of the parent version of the monster coming to rescue its offspring. I want to push back on that one, if I may, and say that after watching Gappa, it's never a twist that it's the parents. Like in Gorgo, we have the monster, and it's a twist in the film that, oh no, this is actually the baby, and the bigger one is coming.
Mm.
Gappa never plays it for a twist. So yeah. To all you out there arguing this one, I'm going to push back gently on you.
I think that's fair. I like your note on the document here that like maybe this is just a classic kaiju story that like a lot of different productions and writers and directors kind of latched onto, you know? And I feel like it's very likely that both Gorgo and Gappa kind of are recycling some of the earlier stories that we see in like I feel like Mothra has that a little bit because the Shobijin are like taken from Infant Island and then taken back to Japan and then Mothra kind of has to rescue them a little bit. So I feel like it's kind of that vibe, you know?
Definitely. I didn't even think about Mothra because I was just thinking about King Kong, which is the obvious, you know, taking a monster from its homeland to exploit it on the entertainment stage. But no, you're right. Mothra does dabble in the monster coming to rescue its brethren in a way.
Yeah. If not its offspring, then like just another, you know, its wards or whatever. It's Ken, yeah. Its brethren, like you said. But yeah, King Kong too. It definitely has that element to it.
I know it's like the one topic everyone's talking about these days. Where did Gappa get its influences? But we're here to talk about it.
Yeah. It's lighting up all the Reddit boards.
We're moving right along.
Oh, yeah.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes. So what do we got in old Minya's mailbox?
All right, so in Minya's mailbox, we have a comment from Dawn Long -S3K. Dawn Long says, Daiei wanted to compete with Toho's Godzilla at the time. Their first kaiju project, Gamera the Giant Monster from 1965, turned out to be more of a success than they had initially expected. Gamera had many traits that separated him from Godzilla. While he is more antagonistic in his debut film, he becomes more of a good guy monster in the sequels. He is best known to be a guardian and friend to all children. After Gamera vs. Zegra from 1971, Daiei had put the series into hiatus until Gamera Super Monster from 1980. The eighth film of the Showa era was a box office failure, and the series went on hiatus again until Gamera Guardian of the Universe in 1995. Thank you, Don Long. That's a fascinating history, and I think I've seen the first two Gamera movies, and then we did talk about another later one on the podcast at some point, right?
Yeah, Guardian of the Universe from the 90s.
Right. And I like them. I like that series, what I've seen of it so far.
You are riding high. You've seen the best of the best.
Okay.
No, best the 90s movies are all top-notch. After the third entry in the Showa era, it goes downhill pretty fast, but might still offer plenty of camp, but less quality, cheaper budgets, lots of stock footage type of stuff.
Okay, that doesn't sound great, but I feel like I like the first two well enough that I do want to continue going with them. So hopefully,
and you should, because Gamera is always better than Gappa and Ebera.
Yes, that's the main takeaway of this episode. And I actually feel like maybe Gappa rips off Gamera more than it does Gorgo, because Gamera definitely has like the friend of the children, and Gappa certainly has that as well. Gappa, the baby Gappa especially, has this like kinship with all these human kids in this movie. So that is taken directly from Gamera, I would say.
And I think that goes back to your point of Nikatsu just including every trope they can oh, this worked for Gamera. Let's put a kid in this movie with some sort of connection. Yeah. Yeah.
That stuff is kind of boring in this movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, because it just feels surface level. Like they never really utilize it as much as they can.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so sentimental. And I think like the main kid in this movie is in blackface, and that's obviously not good. So there are many things that are just like not enjoyable about that theme in this movie.
We'll get there.
Yeah, sorry. Getting ahead of ourselves a little bit.
That's like the biggest thing of this movie. Okay. But Peter Lorre, he was at the Halloween party. He was busting a move. He got a hold of some sort of jack-o'-lantern alcohol pumpkin thingamajig that he was drinking all night. I still haven't seen him. That was 2 weeks ago. He had to disappear for a little bit. But it was great. It was great fun. Wish you could have been there.
Yeah, I wish I could have too. It's hard to imagine Peter Lorre cutting a rug, but that must have been something.
He got down with all the monsters that night.
Man, it was just like a universal reunion at your house, I bet.
I had my VCR TV here. I had it set up in the kitchen, a little corner, like RIP to VHS corner.
Cool.
And people could just, the idea was people could play whatever tapes were available.
Nice.
At their leisure. We ended up, I put in Young Frankenstein to start the night. And then it was really funny because me and Gary and some others, you go get a beer in the fridge and then you find yourself just watching Young Frankenstein for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's a good choice. Young Frankenstein's awesome.
Yeah.
Whenever that's on like TV or whatever, like you can't pull yourself away from it, you know?
Yeah.
That's cool. What else did other people play on VHS that night?
It's actually a friend of mine wanted to play The Thing, the 1951 Thing.
Oh, nice.
But then it wasn't working because the tape was locked. If you recall the tapes, they'd have like a little lock button mechanism on the side.
Yeah. Kind of forgot about that till right now.
Yeah, so we had to fiddle with that and then just pivoted and put in Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh, Bride of Frankenstein, one of my favorites. That's a great choice.
Yeah.
Cool. Did you have any games or activities or anything that night?
Yes. Eyes the Phantom of the Opera hosted a night of fate and madness. So I concocted some games, three rounds of games. Like a dance of doom, I called it, where everyone had to dance. And I called out people who kept moving after I stopped the music. Until I whittled them down to three. And then the three of them had to complete the lyrics to the Monster Mash the best of their ability.
That's amazing. I would be terrible at that.
And then the final two, it was like a relay race. I have like a little toy heart that I had placed in a hidden box and they had to find the Phantom's heart and bring it back to me.
Oh man, that's awesome. You're really good at party planning. That's creative. I love that.
Thank you. It was very silly. Yeah. I led each round with a quote from the 1925 movie.
Cool.
Including the one you mentioned in our episode. Like a toad, I secrete the venom. Something, something, something.
Yeah. I was trying to remember what it was. Yeah, it rings a bell. I don't remember the rest.
When I said that, there was an audible, visceral reaction from the partygoers.
I love it. It's 100 years old and it still holds up.
Yeah. They're like, what in the what?
That's the correct response, I would say. That probably sounded way cooler in that character's head before he said it out loud, you know, in a silent movie or whatever. But it's such a weird, weird choice for dialogue.
Back on track. The Girl Who Dared from 1944. Our letterboxed synopsis reads, a group of people are invited to a party at a creepy mansion where legend has it a ghost appears once a year. And the tagline of the film is, your blood will run cold. It's got those chills and thrills. Chills and thrills.
Nice.
Well, The Girl Who Dared.
Sounds good. Kind of sounds like The House on Haunted Hill a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. We'll see. Can't wait to watch that and hear Peter Lorre's take.
Yeah, if he can find him and like if he's not still on a bender, you know?
Well, that's always the catch, isn't it? I don't know how you lived with the guy for a year.
Oh, man, I'm glad he's not here anymore. Like, I'm, you know, good riddance. I wash my hands of him.
Yeah, man, I didn't know you held grudges like this, but.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the next time I see Peter, it is not going to go well. I'll just say that.
Yikes.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. Yes, this is the Poverty Row Picture Show. And I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Oh, my aching pirate's booty. What a couple of weeks it has been. Friends, I am sorely, sorely deeply sorry for my behavior at Vincent's Halloween party. Yes, I do not even remember leaving, but I do remember waking up on this beach. Yes. The crashing waves were a cold and crude wake-up call. And as I sat there holding my troublesome temples in my hands, like my costume clinging to my perfectly sculpted body, a shadow appeared over me. I looked up into the beaming sun and saw reflected in the sun the raven circling up above. It called to me, demanding the continuance of the poem. Well, I have never been one to disappoint an audience, so there, on the pebbles, I began the words. Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow for the lost Lenore. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood up. I stood repeating, 'tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more. Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. Sir, I said, or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping. Tapping at my chamber door that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken. And the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping somewhat louder than before. Surely, I said, surely that this is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind and nothing more. And then I woke up. and my raven companion led me back to my basement dwelling in Vincent's home. And there, waiting for me, was my life's work. A box of Poverty Row video cassettes. And lying on top, Republic's 1944 picture, The Girl Who Dared. This film is a typical old dark house whodunit, but at a brisk 56 minutes, it is enjoyable enough. Yes, the action begins with a party of socialites who have gathered at a remote seaside home for a ghost hunt. We're out on the beach, amidst the crashing waves. It's a pirate ship haunted by the spirit of a buccaneer. Now, sadly, this does not go anywhere, but there remains a mystery to be solved worthy of Scooby-Doo and the gang. So listeners, check out The Girl Who Dared for an easy, albeit slightly forgettable, little thriller. But next week, on the Poverty Row Picture Show, yes, we are talking Killer Brains. Yes, Killer Brains are on the loose in 1944's The Lady and the Monster.
Must have been a little after 3 o'clock in the afternoon that it began. The afternoon of June 3rd, 1916.
Fire one. Fire two.
This could have been the end. The end of just another tragic episode in war at sea. But for the few survivors of a torpedoed merchant ship and the crew of a German U-boat lost in the frozen South Atlantic, it was the beginning of an incredible adventure. For this was the day the 20th century met the primeval world face to face. American International presents The Land That Time Forgot, an astounding motion picture based on the book by Edgar Rice Burroughs, creator of Tarzan and the most thrilling science fiction stories ever written. Travel through an underwater passage and discover an awesome prehistoric world. Fight for your life against the terrifying creatures of a lost continent. Come face to face with primitive man and learn the secret of evolution, the land that time forgot.
Mr. Tyler!
Starring Doug McClure.
There's a secret to this island. Something that we haven't been able to fathom yet. And whether we stay or get away may depend on it.
It's action, danger, and adventure on an epic scale.
How much longer do we give them?
We're not leaving without them! Forget Skipper! Watch my word, please!
You will never forget Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Land That Time Forgot.
Well, let's get back to Gappa the Triphibian Monster. Let's talk about some themes about this movie. You know, this is one of those movies where I could give it like the film school critique treatment, but like we've talked about, it does try to include everything. So I'm like, well, of course it has themes, but I don't know how seriously I should take Gappa, the Triphibian Monster. You know what I mean?
I do. I feel the same way. The themes are so obvious that it's like, well, do we even have to talk about them? You know, like, I guess you have like science versus entertainment is one of them. And like, well, kind of like the corporate sort of head honcho in the movie is like he leads a company called Playmate, which I thought was kind of funny. I didn't know if that's like a Playboy parody or something, but you know, he wants to open up a theme park with all these exotic animals. And that's clearly like both King Kong and Jurassic Park, of course. So yeah, to your point, it's like, yeah, there are themes and like they're ripped off from like every other monster movie you've ever seen before.
The biggest theme, if you will, that I wanted to bring up was at the end. As sentimental as the ending is, everyone's crying. There's just like sappy lighting. And, you know, I think it's lit really well and shot really well. I don't want to take away from that. but it is very sappy. And the little girl, the daughter of the, you know, the corporate head honcho, she's like, "Daddy, the monsters are together, like the family's together. I miss mommy." And it's just, you know, as sentimental as it is, the family unit that are the Gappas is mirrored by this broken family between the daughter and her dad, who in one scene, the daughter looks up at him and says, "I don't like you anymore."
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
Yep. Very sappy, but pretty heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. She just went cut him to the quick on that one.
Yeah. But I mean, that guy, that like her dad, is like so just like blatantly villainous for much of the movie. He's like, you know, "What would taking the baby Gappa back to the island do? Of like, you idiot, that's not going to do anything." And he's just like so blatantly just like, "No, I'm not doing that. Like, this is our one chance to like make money off of this thing." And it's like, well, no wonder your daughter hates you. You're like a terrible person, you know? But of course, there's the inevitable change of heart at the end. So it all works out. But yeah, it is kind of touching in a way. And like, you also, like you mentioned the love triangle before, and you know, I think it's the reporter and the woman scientist who kind of do have like a little fling going on. And then there's like a conflict between them. Like, he's totally focused on his work and he, you know, doesn't really care about the baby Gappa at all. And that kind of drives them apart. And then, you know, like there's another sappy line at the end where that guy is like, "Well, I've learned that one should not be totally selfish in their life, and it took Gappa for me to learn that." It's like the quote is something like that. I don't remember exactly what it is. And it's like that obvious of a moral lesson. Like, that's pretty much how it's voiced in the movie. But it's like, oh, okay. Like, he's learned some lessons, and now they're getting back together. Like, that is kind of sweet and a little bit, you know?
Yeah. There's one theme that I don't jibe with, but it's a theme of the movie. Our female lead, and the character's name is Itoko Koyanagi. She is an independent woman. She don't need no man. And she's just like, "Bah, bah, stay away from me. All your advances in your flirting." And, you know, because the guys, you know, they're giving her a hard time a little bit, joking around like, "Oh, you're 22. You've got gray hairs." And she says something like, she really holds her own, and she's like, it just rolls off her back, which, like, I really appreciated this empowerment, which was very in with the times, 1960s, you know, at large female independence. But then at the end, her character's arc is to actually settle down and just be a homewife, a housewife, which, no shade if that's what you want to do, but to me, in this film, it just torpedoed everything she had going for herself.
It's kind of confusing, though, because at the end of the movie, she's like, "Oh, well, I guess I will just go like find a man and settle down and be a housewife, like you said." And then she walks away, and it's almost like she's testing one of the guys to see if he'll like chase after her and be like, "No, don't do that. You're like this great reporter. Like, we need you." Or a great scientist, I think she is. Sorry. But so, yeah, the ending is confusing, and it's either so vague that it's kind of frustrating or actually offensive. Like, either way, it's like not a great ending for her, you know?
You know, as we talk about like 1950s monster movies, even 20 Million Miles to Earth, it happens in every movie with every female lead. It's a trope in and of itself, where the female is a scientist, a biologist, a doctor, like in 20 Million Miles to Earth. And then over the course of the movie, that character loses all of her professional ambition, and eventually just settles into a romantic relationship with the male lead, whoever that is, the soldier, the newspaper man, whatever. So in a way, Gappa is also just copying a trope seen in every other giant monster movie.
Yeah. And you're right, that's one of the more unfortunate tropes for sure. I can't, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, like, any female lead in a kaiju movie with agency, and, like, it's hard. I, like, honestly, I don't know if a single one is coming to mind, you know?
I mean, yeah, I mean, they're going to be there. I mean, the, like we talk about the Heisei movies, there's the one girl, the woman who has that telepathic link.
Yeah.
Those are still from the 90s.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely in that later period. And like Godzilla versus Biollante, I think, is that the one that you're talking about, I think? Yeah, and maybe a little bit in, is it Godzilla versus King Ghidorah from 1992? I think there might be some strong, very empowered female characters in that movie. But either way, yeah, it's much later. It's not till after this period.
Do you remember in Them, our female lead, James Arness, tries his hardest to like woo her? And she's the daughter of the main scientist. They might end up together in the end, but the sense is it's so forced because that actor plays such a good, strong character. I just remember that movie came to mind if you want to revisit that one.
Yeah, I do kind of remember that. I like her character in that movie.
Yeah. Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah, that's probably the best example. Literally a strong female character.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to, I'll have to think about that a little bit more, because I'm not thinking of too many examples, but I'm sure there must be some earlier ones too.
But too far and few between.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, just one more theme. I kind of alluded to this before, but just like the depiction of the native islanders, and I think it's called Obelisk Island, where the Gappa monsters are taken from. And like ostensibly the theme is that the natives on the island are mistreated by all the Japanese reporters and scientists that go there. And then like the Japanese characters exploit the island and the people and its creatures and then just leave and try to make money off of it, basically, which hypothetically is an admirable theme. But then, of course, the depiction of the islanders is like, you know, there's blackface, there's like tribal dancing, there's like extremely cliched costumes and sets and everything. So it's kind of like those themes and depictions like balance each other out in the long run. You know, it's hard to see it as very admirable in the end.
Yeah, it's just your classic meaning, like also dated exoticism. These are Japanese actors in this Japanese film, but to liken it to our own culture, you know, the great white hunter goes into Africa and, you know, encounters mysteries beyond their wildest dreams, which we know is dated and talked about it in Congo.
Yep. That goes back to King Kong, like you were talking about before, like probably just yet another example of Gappa just like taking every possible monster movie cliche it possibly can, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like you see that stuff in King Kong and you're like, yeah, that's not great, but this is like 1933 and there's like enough other stuff in the movie to kind of like understand why that's such a classic, you know? But by this time in 1967, maybe not so much. Did you raise your hand?
I did raise my hand. I want to point out that we had actual black actors used in King Kong. For what it's worth, at least the casting was respectful in that way. That doesn't even sound right, but I think you get my point.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just like the disturbing makeup, and disturbing in many ways in this movie, in Gappa, is just hard to watch. And like, you know, on a young child, it's like, what are you teaching this kid? You know, like he's probably not learning very many good lessons from this.
Yeah, and this came up in Mothra too, Ishiro Honda's Mothra. The depiction of the islanders, they are put in like a brown makeup, their whole skin and everything, which is bad enough. But this boy character in Gappa, just like that's full on black.
Yeah.
And he's even wearing a wig.
Right.
And it's just so, it's stupid, honestly. Like, I'm not even, like, I'm upset by it, but I'm also angry at, like, how, it just looks bad. It's just, like, such an obviously bad makeup job as well.
Right, yeah. It's bad in, like, every conceivable way, you know? And, like, it doesn't even really make narrative sense, because if they're in the South Seas, I think that's where Obelisk Island is supposed to be, it doesn't, like, it doesn't even make narrative sense that that character would be there, you know? It's, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's inexcusable in every facet. every way possible. Just yeah, and that it is disappointing because I do enjoy so much of this movie, but would I ever show this movie to a class of my students? Absolutely not. And that, and the same thing with Mothra too. Like I just can't.
Absolutely, yeah, pretty much inexcusable. And like you know, I. Again, like movies from the 30s and the silent era don't get a free pass. We should definitely hold them accountable as well. But like, you know, 1967, like ridiculous. There's no reason for it. Like, and I don't know. I guess I was kind of thinking like maybe there are cultural differences between like American attitudes towards blackface and like Japanese attitudes towards that. But that's irrelevant. It's, you know, it's bad either way. So the cultural differences don't really like obviate that point, you know?
Yeah, that is a such a large web that you tapped into that I'm not even going to pretend like I could be an expert on talking about anything. All I can speak to relatively confidently is Japan's history as an imperial nation and like its Western counterparts going into a quote unquote exotic land and raiding it for its resources, taking advantage of its quote-unquote primitive peoples. Yeah, I mean, it's still an icky colonial mindset.
Yeah.
Even if it's from the Japanese point of view.
Totally. And that's why it's frustrating that Gappa seems to, like, make that critical point. I mean, like, the Japanese characters do that in this movie. They exploit the resources and the people there on the island. But, like, the way it's achieved, it, like, totally defeats that purpose, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, as we already talked about, like, I don't know how much complexity there really is there. They're just like repeating other points that were already made in previous movies. So yeah, it's I would say probably the one of the worst aspects of this movie is the depiction of the native people.
Oh man, okay. I'm just groaning because my final rating I think is fluctuating by the moment here.
Oh,
which is
no.
What I love. I love because, you know, I have an impression of a movie I just watched, but in conversation, you know, you learn things and your perspective starts to shift. So
yeah.
It's good.
That's definitely happened to me a lot on while we record. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we were already talking about this a little bit earlier too, but just like how blatantly obvious and sentimental the dialogue is, and like most of the characters, like it is not believable for a second that like any of these people are actually saying this, the things that they say in this movie. Like they're not really characters, they're kind of just like tropes, you know, to push the story along. Yeah, I mean, from the sort of like crude, vulgar, capitalistic like company man to the like scientists who like only care about the facts and like don't really care about other people or other animals, to these kids who are just like, you know, like saying literally every thought that's in their head, you know, like I'm not saying that it has to be like naturalistic, realistic dialogue all the time, but it's just like impossible to believe in this movie, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Sentimental, over the top, heavy handed. How do you feel about the monster design itself? And I have, if I may, the baby Gappa to me has like a, its face has like a, this is not a smart critique, but it has a dumb look to it. Like something with the eyes, like they're forward set. I don't know. The
yeah.
Baby doesn't work for me. But the adults do. They do look fearsome in the right light, in the right angle. They're
yeah.
like a chimera. They have lots of different aspects of different creatures. But I don't know. Ultimately, I'm like, this is kind of, I don't know, a weak monster design.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think like the adult Gappas work a little bit better. I mean, like the some of the like attack scenes are. Oh, sorry, my cat scared the hell out of me. he does that a lot, surprisingly, while we record. But yeah, like the attack scenes that the, you know, because it is like the adults are triphibian monsters, right? They fly around, they're underwater, they're like on land. And that's kind of cool. And I think that's why the design for me works a little bit better on the adults because like they're just doing cooler things basically, you know, like it's fun to watch and exciting, visceral to use that word I use all the time. But yeah, the baby, I don't know, like at first I was like, this baby looks sad and like kind of disturbing in a way, like it hatches from its egg and then there's this shot of like the baby surrounded by all this like yellow mustardy liquid and it just looks depressing and I'm like, oh, is this intentional? Like, are we supposed to be like really convinced that this baby is like in peril immediately? But then it becomes clear that that's, I don't think it's really intentional. That's just kind of bad creature design, I think, for the baby version of the monster. Mm.
Yeah, you're right. It does look very pathetic and sad in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe again, it's like, all right, you're just playing with my heart here. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, even with the adults, like, it's very kind of like, what's the word? Chintzy design, like very spare and minimalist, you know? And I feel like in a way that kind of works just because like there's so much other crazy stuff happening when like they're being shot by lasers and tanks and they're flying around and stuff like that. But the design itself is like probably not very creative or elaborate, you know?
Maybe not elaborate. I don't know. I'm really torn, clearly. Listeners, please let us know your thoughts. Yeah, I don't love it, but I don't hate it either. I'm just somewhere in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, same. Again, in comparison to like Gauss and Gamera and some other monsters around this time, I feel like Gappa pales in comparison.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Gappas would win in a fight with any of those monsters.
Right. Yeah, they don't even seem to have any like special moves or anything really. Like maybe they have like red laser eyes or something.
Their eyes do glow red. But they also, they do have like an atomic breath sort of thing.
Okay. I honestly think I missed that. Like, there's just so much going on in those attack scenes. And like, you never really know if like they're being shot by missiles or if they're shooting something at the military tanks. I think I might have missed the atomic breath, to be honest, which probably does not reflect very well on the movie.
Well, yeah, I could talk about those scenes as something I like, actually, if you're cool to transition. Yeah,
for sure.
I like how the attack sequences with the missiles and the jets are so chaotic and frenetic, and a couple of times you get the POV of the jets swooping in on the Gappas, which I liked. A couple of times you get the POV from the Gappas themselves, which I found really interesting. There's one shot they're lording over the beach back on Obelisk Island, and you see from their point of view like the humans running away like little ants. I thought that was really cool. I don't know. You may disagree, but I really like the way this movie is generally lit and shot and the photography. I think it's action-packed. I think it moves at a quick pace. I think the colors, anytime there's a sunset, it just, to me, it's like really just pretty to watch.
No, I actually totally agree with you that like it's very well shot. It's a surprisingly good-looking movie, I would say. At least in like the restored version and not the really terrible monster from a prehistoric planet one. But it looks really good. There's like an early shot where the Japanese characters have just arrived on Obelisk Island and they're going into the village, like the native village, but nobody seems to be there and it seems like the place is totally abandoned. And there's like a really quiet, long tracking shot where, and it's from the character's POV, I think. And it's very mysterious and kind of eerie. That's my favorite part of the movie. And it's, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm excited to see where this goes. And then it goes downhill kind of quickly after that. But at least in that particular scene, because then like the native characters come out of the woodwork and it's questionable. But that shot is great. There's an earlier shot where one of the characters on the ship before they arrive on the island sees these like glowing eyes underwater. I thought that was a very cool moment. And yeah, I actually like the attack scenes too. I know I was kind of criticizing them a little bit, but there are a lot of really just dynamic images in those scenes. There's one shot where like the two adult Gappa monsters like fly into the fog and it's just like a very striking, like atmospheric moment. I love that part too. So yeah, it's a pretty good looking movie. I wouldn't say it's always entertaining. I was pretty bored by the end and I was like, come on, let's wrap it up already a little bit, especially with like the long scenes where all the characters are like delivering very preachy moral lessons. But the attack scenes themselves are very entertaining and very exciting. I like the song over the opening credits too, which is kind of silly but very amusing. It reminded me of the blob theme song. It's kind of hard to say, but yeah, I like all that stuff about it.
The stuff on the island in the beginning, very captivating, very quickly, very dreamlike. They go underground into a cave, and there's just like great shrouds of mist and an underground lake that the blue, it's just, yeah, like, I agree with you there. I think where this movie gets long, to your point, is there is a noticeable lack of score underlining a lot of the action. And I think that is a detriment in this case by the end of the film. I think any kind of score would liven things up a bit.
That's a really good point. I don't think I really focused on that too much, but you're totally right. I feel like I thought maybe it was dragging for narrative reasons, but I think it's also for formal reasons like that. So that's a really good point.
Just quiet.
Yeah. Even if there's like a lot of sound effects in the movie, like they're not really like tied together sometimes, you know, by the music.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The effects, the special effects. I think Akira Watanabe does a great job. The pyrotechnics I found really impressive at the end when the Gappas are stomping through. And I'm realizing that those are actors in a suit just being surrounded by explosions and fire.
Yeah.
I hope there was a man with a fire extinguisher right off camera.
Right. Yeah, those actors in the suits must kind of go through hell, you know? We've talked about that a little bit on the podcast before, but it cannot be comfortable in those suits for, like, whatever, 10 hours a day while they're shooting, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I love all that, too. There are, like, a lot of pyrotechnics, like you said. The volcano on the island I thought looked pretty cool, and that's, you know, there are a couple eruption moments that were kind of fun. So I love all that stuff. Pretty exciting at times.
What about campy stuff?
I think it would be easier to find moments that aren't campy in this movie. You know, again, just like every line of dialogue is like saying exactly like what the theme is or like what the characters are thinking. Like, so I guess the one example that I'll bring up is like the character that's intended to be comic relief towards the beginning, who's like, I think a photographer, and like he like hooks his shirt on a like fishing line when he's like fishing off of the boat, and then he like is like looking for treasure on the island, and he accuses the other characters of like trying to steal his treasure from him or whatever. And it's supposed to be funny, but it's one of those examples of like comic relief that's like unintentionally funny, if that makes sense, because it's so over the top and ridiculous, you know.
Yep. There was a moment when the Gappas, the two parents, first come ashore, and one of them has an octopus in its beak. And it's attacking the whole city with this really dumb-looking octopus prop in its mouth. Eventually, it falls away. But I was like, that's a choice. That is a funny choice that you're making right here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. I think that's an example of intentional humor that actually kind of works. I think it's supposed to be intentional anyway. But yeah, that's a really campy, like, very humorous moment for sure.
Oh, man. Playmate Land, what are we doing? Like, is this Hugh Hefner? He creates an island for tourists, but it's an animal themed island. I don't know what they were going for.
Yeah. No idea. Maybe it's not supposed to be a Playboy reference, but I just feel like it must be in the late 60s to like use that kind of like tycoon sort of character, you know?
And what else would Playmate refer to?
Right.
I just can't think of anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes no sense. I'm like,
no wonder your daughter doesn't like you. You're a dirty old man.
Yeah. You're kind of a sleazeball. There's a lot of stuff with that character that's just so ridiculous. Like, you know, when they're first trying to like research the Gappa monsters, and like one of the other characters, like one of that guy's employees, sorry. So like the main guy, the corporate guy, is like, what's the height? And then the other guy is like 5 feet. And then like the other guy is like, oh, well, it's not like how tall a person is that matters. And then the other guy is like, oh, it's referring to like Gappa's height. And then the corporate guy is like, you idiot, why didn't you tell me that? That's it's a drawn-out way of describing that scene, but it's like, the dialogue is ridiculous, and like, I don't know, that's a very campy moment too, where like everything is painted in very broad strokes, you know?
Yeah. Last thing, at the end, everybody is crying, including the Gappas themselves. These giant kaiju have tears coming down their cheeks. It's like, all right, we have now left the realm of plausibility here.
Oh, yeah. Even more than we already had. Yeah. Right. And I think that's why the ending feels so drawn out to me, because like every character has their like, you know, sentimental thing that they have to say. It's like, oh, we get it, man. Like, yeah. We get the point. And yeah, the tears do make it even more obvious.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, that's, I think, I don't know. Can we say anything more about this movie, or should we just give our final ratings?
I don't know how much more there is to say about it. It's just such a hodgepodge of cliches, you know? So I feel like we can move into our ratings.
Let's do it.
All right. Yeah, so as usual on Camp Kaiju, we have four ratings for our films that we talk about. Number one, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
Oh boy.
This is kind of a tough one. I imagine that you and I are both gravitating between two particular ratings.
I get that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to go first? I'll go first.
Okay.
Watching this movie, my first instinct was there are some antiquated moments. The blackface, terribly dated and offensive. The female character arc, terribly dated, offensive.
Yeah.
But, you know, I said to myself, I think the special effects are so good, and I think the technical aspects are so good that I think it does stand the test of time as an underrated entry in the genre. Now, after we've talked about it, and I'm saying how offensive all these aspects are, I think I got to go one below. That the exception is the technical aspects, but I think the overwhelming lasting impression of this film is, oh, it's the one with the kid in blackface. And that, my friend, means this movie does not stand the test of time. Oh, that's right. You know, it's fun. It has some redeeming qualities, but overall, I don't think this does stand the test of time.
Yeah, I think you're right that if that's like the main thing it's known for, that probably has to go in that category. So for you, it's the second lowest rating, right? It has some Correct. Fun moments, but okay.
Yeah.
I'm still having trouble deciding, but you know, I so rarely give movies our lowest rating. I think Killdozer is the only one that I've given our lowest rating to so far. But I think this is going to be the second one, I'm sorry to say. I mean, like you said, I do like some of the special effects. I do think it's well shot, and I do think there are some individual moments that look really good and are very atmospheric. But I think those are such notable exceptions to an overall, like, pretty cliched, offensive, like drawn out movie that had completely lost me by the end. I'm sorry to say, it is just not worth revisiting for me. It definitely does not stand the test of time. I'm not saying that people shouldn't see it once for those like individual moments that are kind of like striking looking and to have, you know, like a magical sense to them, a sense of visual style. But yeah, if only to make a decisive stand, I think I have to give this our lowest rating.
And I'm not arguing with you on that. It's derivative. It's cliche ridden. I've seen it twice now. But this movie is for those of us who have gone through our starters and even the B squad. And we're like, you know what? What else is out there? Gappa.
Yeah.
Who made it late to practice. But they showed up, and you'll give them a shot. Go take what you got.
The emergency third stringer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I could kind of see somebody, like you kind of talked about this before, sticking up for this movie a little bit and saying, like, oh, no, it's underrated. There are good things about it. I can understand somebody making that point, but I just don't agree. And, yeah. So watch it once, but for me, it's probably not going to be worth revisiting.
There you go. There you have it, folks. Please let us know what you think about Captain the Triphibian Monster. And tell us about it. Leave us a positive rating and review. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you do that, please, we would appreciate it. You can share this podcast with all your friends on a tote bag. Don't forget to check us out at patreon.com/campkaiju. You can also subscribe to our website and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. All those links and more in the show notes. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612. And check out our website. I already said that. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minya's Mailbox music by Ben Cookfeltz. Thank you, friends. And until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
And here will be an outdoor restaurant. The visitors we'll be able to enjoy a meal in tropical splendor. And on the stage, we will have primitive dances from the islands. Well, that's the entire plan.
Very good. The publishing business is now getting into the tourist business.
You're right. And every one of you will be able to enjoy a Southeast trip without leaving the country. Right here. 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 Right here.
Oh, very good. Wonderful.
It's terrific.